Black Lives Matter. June 6, 1944, Allied troops storm the beaches of Normandy. D-Day, an event memorialized in books, documentaries, and films such as Saving Private Ryan. And now, over 70 years later, more truth revealed. I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. Today we look at the injustices of 1940s Jim Crow America and the valor of an all-black battalion whose D-Day contributions have been largely ignored until now. Linda Hervieux reveals the compelling story of the 320th Barrage Balloon Battalion in her book, Forgotten, The Untold Story of D-Day's Black Heroes, at Home and at War. I will talk with Linda in just a moment. Later in the broadcast, we'll talk with Jeannie Sloan, whose fascination with women's contributions to the war efforts has led to a trilogy of books. She Flew Bombers, She Built Ships, and her most recent, She Was an American Spy During World War II. Stay with us. It's a novel idea. Linda Hervieux is a journalist and photographer whose work has appeared in national and international publications. She is a native of Lowell, Massachusetts, and has lived for many years now in Paris, France. Linda was surprised to discover that the black soldiers involved with the D-Day invasion were just not covered, not written about, not talked to, not featured in the monumental films and books written. And she took on the mission of exposing their stories. What she discovered was not just a military history, but a social one, another piece of our national shame of racism, all the more egregious that it was practiced on those serving our country in the military. Here is my conversation with Linda Hervieux.
Welcome to this part of California.
Thank you.
70 years after the invasion of Normandy, after D-Day, we're still discovering forgotten tales. And in fact, your book, Forgotten, The Untold Story of D-Day's Black Heroes at Home and at War, is just that. Exposes us to a lot of things we may have forgotten or never even knew. What brought you to approach this subject and to be drawn to telling these stories?
In June of 2009, the French government chose an American veteran from Virginia to honor. I'm a freelance writer living in Paris, and I was looking for an interesting story to write about. So I wrote about this veteran named Bill Dabney from Roanoke, Virginia, along with a lot of other reporters. We wrote about Bill being a member of the only black combat unit at D-Day, and that they flew these strange balloons over the beaches that formed a sort of aerial curtain. And we were told that Bill was part of an all-black battalion and that the army was segregated in World War II, which if I had ever learned, I had long forgotten that that was the case. And it seemed a shame to just do one story on Bill and the 320th Barrage Balloon Battalion. So I tried to find more men who might still be alive. They told us he was the last one, but it turned out nobody had really checked. They just assumed because these men were in their 90s and Bill was the youngest of his company, he told us. He was 17 when he signed up. They just assumed there weren't any more men, but there were. I found a dozen and the families of many others.
And it seems like one of the people you spoke with actually said something like he'd been waiting maybe 70 years for somebody to come and talk to him.
Yeah, that was Wilson Monk, who is from Atlantic City. He leads the book on the boardwalk fascinating story, Black Atlantic City. And he was in Silver Spring, Maryland when I found him, had lived for years outside of Washington, D.C. And that's exactly what he said. I've been waiting for somebody to call me for 50 years, which wasn't entirely true. His son had tried to get him to tell the story earlier. But like many, many veterans, those of us who most reporters know, you interview a war veteran around the holidays, Veterans Day, Memorial Day, you ask them to tell their stories. They don't want to. They don't want to remember those times. They don't want to tell those stories. So I was lucky that a lot of these men were ready to do that.
And some of them have died subsequent to...
Yes, including Wilson Monk. Bill Dabney, who started this whole thing with me, he and I were... Last week, we appeared at the Bedford World War II Memorial in Virginia together. He's going strong. He's a wonderful man. He's 92 years old now. So,
and before we launch too deeply into this, maybe you can explain to me and our listeners really what barrage balloons are. I looked at pictures on the internet. I tried to understand how they worked, and I think for our listeners, you might recall seeing pictures maybe of World War II London with these giant, what I thought were some sort of dirigibles, but never really knew what they did. So can you tell us how they work?
Yes. So the principle of a barrage balloon is to keep enemy planes from strafing, from dive bombing important sites. The ones you saw over London were protecting monuments, Big Ben, Parliament, defense plants across England, and along the U.S. West Coast. Shortly after Pearl Harbor, they went up from San Diego to the Canadian border. They went up some spots on the East Coast as well. And the idea was to protect the coast from a land invasion. They were above Navy yards, defense plants, that kind of thing. And they were tethered to the ground with what is essentially piano wire. And the wire was enough to cause a plane to stall and crash. Pilots were terrified of them. Ideally, they fly in a sawtooth pattern into the clouds, so they can't always be seen. They were supposed to be flying at Pearl Harbor, and if they had been flying in December of 1941 as they were supposed to be, it would be interesting to see what would have happened, or if the Japanese would have launched that sneak attack. I talk about that in Chapter 4. Barrage balloons were fascinating to me. They're filled with either helium or explosive hydrogen. Hydrogen's easy to make in the field. So that was the choice for the balloons that went to war. The balloons that went to war had a secret punch also. They had little bombs that were tethered to the top of the balloon. So with a cable strike, the bomb would be dislodged. It would descend. A good hit could blow a hole through the wing. It could explode the gas tank.
So they weren't really, or are not, very high tech, but kind of form a web that that planes fly into.
They're not high tech. In fact, the balloons go back all the way to the Napoleonic Wars. Napoleon was the first person who formed a balloon corps. The idea behind the balloons was to be observation balloons, so you could call them maybe the first drones. And they carried through to wars up until the 20th century. So they were in the American Civil War. They were in World War I, flown by Americans, and with people in them observing. And then they became this defensive weapon in World War II, flying up into the clouds over the Normandy beaches. They were used all over. They were used in Tokyo. They were in Europe. The Germans had them.
This book does arrive at D-Day, but a good part of the book really is an examination, a re-examination, if one can take a fresh look at racism. It did seem to bring the culture of the time really to life, especially in these black communities where these men came from. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about just including so much of that in the book.
Yeah, this is really a story of Jim Crow America and the journey of these men through navigating that terrain, which was really quite surprising to me when I learned the actual details of how horrible America was in the 1940s for African Americans. It's not a history we learn in school. It's one of the reasons I wrote the book. I had a pretty normal Massachusetts education, and I did not learn this. So with Wilson Monk, the man I was speaking about who said I'd been waiting for 50 years for someone to call, when he started telling me his stories about the Atlantic City boardwalk and the northern segregation too, I mean, this was not Jim Crow, southern legal segregation. This was sort of de facto northern segregation. I was stunned by those stories, so I led the book with it. We also have Sharecropping Virginia, Chapter 3. Henry Parham, who's now living in Pittsburgh, he's still with us. His story was fascinating to me, too, and he was very reluctant to tell it. I found members of his family who helped flesh it out, members that he had not been in touch with since he was a child. I was so fascinated with the sharecropping world, which was really only a couple steps from slavery for these people who were living this barter economy life with really no schooling for their children beyond a few grades, even though separate but equal was the law of our land. And then Henry Parham goes to Richmond, Virginia to get work. And the choices he had to make when America was about to go to war were quite interesting to me. So I think people who are expecting a war story, because this book is filed under military history in many bookstores, I hope they're not disappointed, because this is really a social history of America and the journey from these men through that land to freedom in Europe. Quite unexpected for these men, it was in Great Britain. For other African Americans, the hundreds of thousands who left this country during the war, they found this freedom in pretty much anywhere they went, whether it was the Pacific or in Europe, even in occupied Germany, which is interesting. A people steeped in that sort of racist Nazi creed since 1933, you know, far over a decade, and then they were welcoming to African Americans. So that for me was fascinating.
Well, that's where I feel that the book is of expanded interest to people, because it draws you into these people's lives. And you're right, we don't learn about Jim Crow in school. And I think that some people might not even really grok what that's all about, because we don't think of our country necessarily as having had kind of codified institutional racism the way it was exhibited at those times.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And I wonder if you even mentioned something early in the book about where that term came from, and maybe you could, and that people used it really in just the course of language and all seemed to know what it was a shorthand for.
Yeah, it was really interesting to me to discover the history of Jim Crow. And, you know, Jim Crow was a minstrel figure, mocking a white man, mocking a black minstrel figure. And it just became adopted as the name for black, what was also called black codes, which was a series of laws that spread after the South sort of took back their land after the Civil War, after Reconstruction. And by 1890, you know, so we just have a few decades after the Civil War, Jim Crow laws had spread across the South, sort of like a poisonous weed, so that the separation of the races was all but ensured in every sort of public sector. So it wasn't just back of the bus, though. It was sidewalks. So an African American on a sidewalk had to get off that sidewalk and avert his or her eyes when passing a white person, things like this. One of the crimes was pretending to be a white man, you know. So we have these sort of really nebulous laws that were essentially what the white people in charge decided was going to be the law. And I think that to understand the impact of these laws, you have to sort of look at what happened when the men from the North went South, these Northern recruits, men like Wilson Monk, who got on a train car in New Jersey you know, and as I say in the book, Atlantic City was no piece of cake for African Americans either. You know, it started out as a very integrated place to work and to vacation, and then by the early 1900s was slowly pushing the black workers, the migrants who came from the South, from Virginia mostly, places like that, pushing them to their own neighborhoods. So, you know, Wilson Monk was used to this sort of treatment, right? Second-class treatment. But this was something else entirely. He's on the train somewhere north of Washington, D.C. He's told he has to move to the Negro car, and he doesn't know what that is. Some people told me, how could he not know? But he didn't. You know, a lot of these men didn't know what was going to hit them. And so the Negro car was always hard by the dirty, noisy coal engine. So a black soldier in his crisp uniform was covered in soot when he got to where he was going. And that was only the beginning of it. At Fort Eustis, Virginia, where Wilson Monk first trained, he talked about how the, you know, the racial slurs were just being hurled left and right. He'd never been spoken to that way in his life. So you have to understand that these men were furious before they even began training. And for the Southern men I interviewed, they said, you know, we knew that this is what this was like, but it was the men from the North who really bristled at this and could not believe that their Southern brothers were accepting of this.
And chain gangs, something we might not realize, that that form of essentially slavery affected soldiers as well.
Yeah, that was interesting. You know, when I was first interviewing these men, there was a man in this battalion named Albert Wood from Baltimore. I really enjoyed speaking to him. He was by far the most bitter about this treatment still to this day. And it was interesting because he kept saying to me, I didn't want to leave the bases in the South where we were billeted. And their main camp was in Tennessee at a place called Camp Tyson outside a little town called Paris. And that's where these men spent the bulk of their, that's where they trained, at the Barrage Balloon Training Camp. Their camp built specifically for the purposes of training men, 30 units during the war, four of which were black. But Albert Wood wouldn't leave base. And he said that to me. He said, I was so scared to leave because I was scared that a Southern cop would charge me with a crime I didn't commit and I would get thrown on a chain gang and I would never be seen again. I'd heard these stories. And, you know, I was listening to him, and this is probably 2011. I spoke to him, I believe, in the spring. And I thought, well, really? I mean, did you have to be that scared, you know? And then I read a book called Slavery by Another Name, which won the Pulitzer Prize a couple years ago. And it explains this whole system of basically post-slavery slavery, where you could be charged with vagrancy if you were a man of color for not having a nickel in your pocket and just disappeared into a system where you were charged legal fees you couldn't pay, and then someone would step in and pay it for you, but you had to work it off. And men just disappeared into coal mines, never to be seen again. You know, horrific conditions, many cases worse than the conditions of slavery. And I suddenly understood exactly what he was talking about. And he probably didn't know that detail. I'm sure he didn't. But it suddenly became clear to me the fear. Because he wasn't the only man who told me he was scared to leave base. Other men were. Henry Parm didn't want to leave base either.
I was surprised how many of the subjects in your book actually used that term of they treated us like slaves.
Little dogs.
They thought of us as inhuman. And indeed, they did, even in their training, kind of in promotional material, in literature put out by the military, mm-hmm. were stating that these people didn't learn as well. They couldn't perform as well. So then how did this 320th of black soldiers, the barrage balloons, how did they get chosen to be deployed on D-Day?
We don't know the answer to that. I tried to find the answer to that. I don't know. I speculate in the book as to perhaps why they were chosen. Black soldiers who had been designated for non-combatant jobs, black soldiers had a really wonderful, lush history in this country since the Revolution. But then somehow, by the World Wars, they had been relegated. So the infantry battalions that they had been part of had been curtailed, so that we had two infantry divisions of black soldiers, undertrained, underfunded, really sent out into the field, places like Italy, unprepared, and that they did a good job was really wonderful, because everything was against them. And I describe this in detail in the book. However, there were new challenges that were given to black soldiers, perhaps because of the influence of the NAACP, which was gaining strength, the Urban League, Philip Randolph's train porter union was really powerful at that time too. African Americans were gaining political power, and perhaps for this reason, and of course with the influence of Eleanor Roosevelt, the First Lady, who was the best friend of the black soldier in World War II, her efforts helped create units like the Tuskegee Airmen, the coalition of black pilots that escorted many, many bombers and other white pilots to safety, and those pilots not even knowing that their escorts, whose planes had red tails, that's why they were called the Red Tails, were black. Perhaps because of those efforts, we had four African-American barrage balloon battalions among the 30 that trained at Camp Tyson. We don't know, but I think that that's a pretty good guess.
That was something that surprised me. All the undercurrents of conversation going on at high level, Eleanor Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, Eisenhower, and they're fighting a major war. They're entering the war in Europe. The Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor, and there's this undercurrent of racial tension that permeates it all and is inescapable. And that somehow was a side of World War II that I don't think I was aware of before.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. The whole idea that these men arrive in Britain after a harrowing, harrowing crossing aboard a converted Cunard ocean liner through the North Atlantic, which is just filled with German subs just hunting for ships like theirs. They're crossing alone because these ships were the fastest passenger ships in the world, zigzagging every 15 minutes, throwing them in this way and that. They were terrified, the men on this ship. Bill Dabney in Virginia recounted this last week to an audience with me, and people were fascinated to hear. That was harrowing enough. Then they arrive to this great surprise in November of 1943. They land in Scotland. They board trains. They head south. And they're treated amazingly well. They're treated like Americans. You know, I have a video trailer on my website, which is myname.com. And you can hear the men say, you know, we were Americans first. You know, Arthur Guest from South Carolina said to me, it was like a spark of light. You see a different way of living. And they realized that race hatred was not a natural state of affairs, that there was no reason to treat a significant portion of our population like second-class citizens, like people who were not worthy of respect, like people who had smaller brains, which is what the Army literature at the time said, which was one of the justifications for putting these men in labor battalions.
And the white soldiers in Great Britain could not let it go. Could not let it go that the black soldiers were actually enjoying some degree of liberty that they didn't at home. And I don't know where the term the ugly American actually came from, but it could have come right from our soldiers in Great Britain during World War II.
It could have. And, you know, that's interesting you say that, because this also is a story we don't really know about, is that you hear about Americans abroad and how everyone was so happy to have us. But what you don't hear is that these white GIs largely wore out their welcome in Britain. Of course, so many people were still supporting them. George Orwell was a newspaper columnist, and he wrote about this bad behavior, drunken, unruly, insulting bad behavior by white GIs, and readers wrote in and said, stop it, you know, leave them alone, we need them. So clearly there were defenders, but George Orwell wrote, the only Americans with any manners were the Negroes, because by and large, the black GIs were so appreciative of this treatment. And also, they did not think that the British were so backwards like the white GIs did. The white GIs were appalled by the quality of the food, the plumbing, the appliances, the haircuts, the clothes, and everything was a subject of criticism. But largely, remember, 75% of African Americans in World War II came from the rural South. And a lot of them, like I mentioned, especially those from sharecropping country, had, you know, were living on practically a barter system of that was their economy. And even black salaries across America were more in line with British salaries than with white American salaries. So there was this sort of economic simpatico. There was this real mutual respect. And from everything I found, and I did a lot of research on black GIs in Britain and the National Archives in Britain through British newspapers for 4 years that I consulted, you have a lot of stories about really lovely treatment toward black soldiers. You have some, sometimes where the American army did succeed in imposing Jim Crow in some towns, separating the races. But by and large, the problems were not at the top of the army. They were just the rank and file Southern white GIs who were very angry at this treatment of black GIs and took it out not only on the black Americans, but also took it out on the black colonial troops from the Caribbean who were training in Britain. Britain did a lot to try to emphasize that these soldiers from the colonies were equal citizens in Britain so that they would be treated well by Britons. And the Americans were doing a good job of messing that up.
And I thought it was interesting that the British citizens had to go to work defending black soldiers, and even when white soldiers were kind of having their way with things over there, and that even when crimes were committed or there was a form of justice that was meted out by the military, that the British citizens actually objected to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was interesting. You know, the book, I talk in chapter 7 about how the British officials, you know, they did not want African Americans coming over because they didn't want the importation of America's problems. They were terrified there would be lynching on British soil, white GIs attacking black GIs. They were right. There weren't any episodes of lynching. There were, however, unfair court-martials and executions of black soldiers that I talk about by the American Army. However, all of the predictions came true in other ways. So it did create a huge problem on the British continent, and it was largely because there was a loophole. You know, usually U.S. courts martials are closed, but because the foreign secretary insisted that if British civilians were involved, those court martials were open trials. Only because of that did some soldiers get spared. And I tell the story of Leroy Henry, one of them, who was really a nationwide sensation across Britain. When he was charged with a rape, he clearly did not commit. You know, the facts of this case were so crazy that you read what happened and you think, what? You know, how could he possibly be charged with rape? And, you know, the penalty was execution for that. So Eisenhower stepped in. But only after this was a cause célèbre across the UK, and people just went crazy. There were petitions, pastors came out, and it was this is the run up to D-Day, when we're supposed to be training and working on the invasion of Europe, not really being so preoccupied with American GI relations, you know. So,
and in the book, you take us through their lives and cultural lives in America, and then moving into being deployed to Great Britain. But then you take us right into D-Day, and that was an ugly, bloody mess.
Yeah, it was. We all have heard the stories of the landings at Omaha Beach. We've seen maybe Saving Private Ryan, and we've seen that carnage. But what we don't know and what the movies don't show us is that there were men of color in that landing, soldiers who arrived early, like one man in my book, Waverly Woodson, a college student, medic, whose landing craft was hit. He was wounded. He lands at Omaha Beach in the heat of it, really in the thick of just this hell, this maelstrom swirling around him. He begins saving lives, pulling men out of the water, you know, dispensing blood plasma, pulling out bullets, doing what he can do, amputates a right foot, saves four drowning men at the very end when he can almost do no more, collapses 30 hours after he puts his boots on Omaha Beach. And we found out he's nominated for the Medal of Honor. He never received it. No black soldiers did in World War II until Bill Clinton awarded seven in 1997. His story was so fascinating to me. I'd heard the stories of the landings from other men and then discovered his story and the idea that, well, there's something that can still be done about that. We award the Medal of Honor posthumously in this country, and there is actually a campaign underway. There's a petition by the family. My website links to their petition. And Congressman Chris Van Hollen from Maryland is leading the campaign to win him the Medal of Honor.
Say his name again.
Waverly Woodson, and he is from West Philadelphia. And his widow, Joanne, who's just a wonderful, wonderful woman, she's done some interviews with me. There are links also on my website to those interviews if you want to hear Joanne, because she is just wonderful, wonderful. And, you know, she's working tirelessly on this in Washington. We were together last week in Washington talking about this.
Linda, this is so well researched, yet not academic. It is a smooth read that draws in the reader into stories we may only think we are familiar with. What was your approach to, one, doing the research and then creating this flow when this is your first book?
Thank you for saying that. Being told as a journalist that it's a well-written book for me is huge, and I really appreciate hearing that, because the idea was to write the kind of book that I would want to read, and I like history books that tell people stories and also that have sort of self-contained chapters, so you can just pick up and put down each chapter. I try to write like a long magazine piece. So if you're interested in the history of black soldiers, you can pick up, put down. If you're interested in barrage balloons, whole chapter on ballooning, which might be too much for some people, but I just loved that subject. So that's why I did that. I mean, my process was, you know, I love the research part. I'm a reporter. That's, you know, I've been a journalist since I was 17, and that's been a long time. And, you know, I was very interested in how you find records that are so hard to find and how you sort of unlock men's memories when they're in their 90s and they've not talked about this. Many of them had not talked about it ever, even to their kids. So for me, it was a hunt for records, how to figure out how to find their names, how to find the records across this country, because World War II records are scattered in America. So whether you're at the Eisenhower Library, Truman Library in the Midwest, the National Archives outside D.C., the personnel records in St. Louis, Missouri, that is a treasure trove in some ways, because that's where payroll records are. And that's how I found the names of the men in this unit. But they also had a fire in 1973 that destroyed 80% of their records, including Waverly Woodson's. So how you sort of tie that together was a big challenge. And then visiting the men every year from 2010 to 2013, you know, I spoke on the phone with them often, but it was the in-person visits where I could show them pictures that really made a big difference. When I got the name of their ship, the Acadia, that unlocked a lot of memories for the men. The son of one of the men gave me a berthing card for the E deck, which was the second to the lowest deck. The black soldiers were always put at the very bottom, and it was terrifying for them. So there were, you know, decks from A to F, and these men were on E and F. And, you know, things like that were just so interesting to me. You know, they were just like eureka moments.
And so you were triggering memories when you were talking to these men. And that is, I mean, what a privileged position to be in.
Well, that's how I felt when I didn't know if I would have enough to write a book. I kept thinking, but they've talked to me and they've shared so much. Like, how can I not finish this? You know, I did. If you told me it was going to take 6 years at the beginning, I don't know, one, if I would have had the stamina to tell you that I could work on a book that long. I mean, three of those years were beyond full time. The other three were part time, but that was also tending to full time. You know, I was trying to still make a living as a journalist, not knowing if I was going to sell the book proposal. That didn't happen until 2013. And then stretching an advance that you get as an author to, you know, cover the rest of my research and four researchers who had to be hired to help along the way. But I just felt I owed it to these men. And I don't mean to praise myself for that. I just mean, what was I going to do? I couldn't stop. You know, I couldn't say, oh, there's not enough money to keep going or anything like that. I just had to make it work. And I'm lucky that, you know, I've been working for, you know, 25 years as a journalist, so I've saved some money. I also have a husband who could help cover our household bills. So this made it possible, because it's not possible. People keep telling me you have to keep telling stories like this. And it's very hard for authors to do that, because most authors don't make money from their books. But, you know, when people trust you like that, and it was, I did feel honored. I did feel privileged that they were telling me. And who else is going to tell? If somebody else had been working on this book, I fully expected to go to the National Archives in early 2010 and have other people working on this book, because when we all wrote these stories in June of 2009 on Bill Dabney and this forgotten unit, I wrote it for the New York Daily News. The New York Times wrote about it. Associated Press, a lot of press covered this. And I thought, well, people who write books like this will be doing this. But nobody was. So I thought, okay, well, I have to take a breath and see how long it's going to take. But I never thought it would take this long. I never thought it would be till, you know, October of 2015 till this book would come out.
Well, it was well worth the effort, Linda, to produce a book that exposes some very harsh and difficult realities for us to look at in our own national experience. But it really does bring those people to life in a very warm way. And I think it's a great read, and congratulations on that.
Well, thank you so much.
And thank you so much for coming and joining us today.
Thank you, Suzanne.
My conversation with Linda Hervieux, and the book is Forgotten, the Untold Story of D-Day's Black Heroes at Home and at War. Her website is well-produced, and you might spend some time there, too, as it has some value-added companion material to the book. Linda Hervieux, doing my best French pronunciation, is spelled H-E-R-V-I-E-U-X. We'll take a short break with the Andrew sisters. When we come back, we'll talk with Jeannie Sloan on her latest book of women during World War II, She Was an American Spy. I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea.
He was a famous trumpet man from out Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was the top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blowin' reveille. He's the boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B. They made him blow a bugle for his Uncle Sam. It really brought him down because he couldn't jam. The captain seemed to understand, because the next day the cap went out and drafted a band. And now the company jumps when he plays reveille. He's the boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B. A toot, a toot, a toot-de-la-da, toot-de blows it eight to the bar. In boogie rhythm, he can't blow a note unless the bass and guitar is playing with him. He makes a company jump when he plays reveille. He's the boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B.
Jeannie Sloan has published historical fiction focused on women during World War II. She built ships during World War II, and she flew bombers, which was a winner of the 2012 Indie Book Award. Here I talk with her about her recent publication, She Was an American Spy,
during World War II. Your book is your third book.
Yeah, it's my third historical fiction. The first historical fiction I wrote was She Flew Bombers. The second one I wrote after I found interesting material after doing research about the women pilots is she was a shipbuilder during World War II.
And so this is part of a larger path for you as an author, this latest book on female spies during World War II.
Well, I found that I really, really enjoyed doing research. And so I spend a lot of time doing research before I even write. And I thoroughly enjoy researching amazing, powerful women of the 40s. The men went off to war, and they had to step up and become independent.
And in that process, discovered a lot about themselves.
It is so interesting to me that they only really had 2 or 3 years of being independent. Then they had to go right back to being housewives, enjoying their new 1950s appliances, and were expected to multiply.
And did to a certain extent. And why do you think that dynamism and courage that these women exhibited didn't somehow carry through into the 50s and that it really took maybe 20, 25 more years for women to regain a place in the workforce?
Yeah, that's what I think did happen. But what happened to the women where they then gave up their independence once again was because the men all came back. And they fought a long, hard war, and many women lost their jobs, like the shipbuilders. Even some were widows and had children and still needed to support themselves, and they had to give up their jobs. So the women really then had to go back to being dependent.
Jeannie, you do a lot of historical research, yet you're writing fiction. And so that is a delicate dance. Why have you made that choice to write fiction rather than nonfiction about the period?
My historical fictions, all the details are historically accurate. I just fictionalize the characters. Why I like to do that, I do it for 2 reasons. I can combine real characters into one. And I think it brings a reader right into the time zone.
Well, let's set up the story a little bit. She is married to a man who you establish right away that they don't have children and that they also don't have maybe a very active sex life.
Mm-hmm. And I had reasons for putting that in.
And she also has a twin brother. Mm-hmm. And her brother and husband end up going off to war, leaving her behind. And she also has a mother.
Yes.
With dementia. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to give too much of the story away, but so that to me felt like a very contemporary conundrum in a way that many of us are facing that with our parents. And tell me a little bit about how you set up her family.
Well, the goal was that her husband joined the army, her brother joined the army, and she was then left with her mother. And her mother had dementia, and it, in a way, it gave her something to do while waiting for her husband to come home from the army. So then I had her mother die, and she really was getting quite bored of doing nothing. And thus, that's how she entered into, you know, becoming a spy and into spy training. Just briefly, my mother did have dementia, and it was very therapeutic for me to be writing about that. And quite a few little incidences were factual in my life. So that was kind of interesting.
She goes to a spy camp and then advanced training overseas. And, you know, Jeannie, I thought it was kind of funny because I knew that you had personally, as part of the research for the book, done some skydiving.
Mm-hmm.
And so she has just this horrible fear, this real fear and aversion and maybe having to jump out of a plane into enemy territory.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't help but to think, well, that maybe some of that reflected your experience.
And it did. It's such an adventure for me to write a book because I end up doing as many hands-on experiences as possible. And I decided I really should go skydiving and see what is it like to fall out of a plane. And I had written about it a little bit and researched about it for the spy training. And I found the experience mostly pretty terrifying.
Catherine, or Kitty, is what her spy name becomes. She had to go through all this training, learning Morse code, which was mm-hmm. a big thing. You talk a lot about that as a communication, and that even people, practitioners of it, had their own style.
Their fist, yes.
Oh, that's, yes, it's yeah. called their fist,
yeah.
So that you can almost tell who was sending that message.
Yeah, I had an interesting hands-on experience in researching wireless transmitters, and I really wanted to see one. I always want to see everything. It enhances my writing, just like I wanted to see a World War I Curtis Jenny for my first book, and it took months to find one. And it took me a long time to try to find a World War II wireless transmitter. Someone from my Redwood writing group said to me, well, why don't you contact the ham operators? I think there's a group in Sonoma County. And this whole time I'm thinking ham operator was not something I even related to the word. And so I found on the internet there was one, and I emailed the president, and he emailed me back and said, I'll find one for you. And then I got an email from him saying, I found someone in Windsor, which is right near where I live, who owns one. And I got to go to his house, and he let me transmit on it. He was in the Air Force. He was a former patent attorney. He ended up reviewing my book, going over all the wireless transmitter parts, and it was a lot of fun.
Well, so that's the upside of all the research. You get to meet a lot of cool people and
do
a lot of cool things.
And have a lot of adventures.
Yes.
Like shooting a Colt 45.
Uh-huh. Did you get good at it?
No.
Oh, okay.
It was a good experience. I was so surprised how heavy it was. It doesn't look heavy. It's just a pistol. And I think I hit maybe the bottom of the paper plate.
Kitty had a hard time too at first.
Yes, and Kitty, of course, had trouble shooting, as I did.
She was kind of interesting in that she didn't have a great degree of self-confidence, but she just went with it. She just, you know, went with it, and people seemed to, she didn't really judge any of it either. She just kind of, oh, okay, this is what I have to learn now. This is what I'm given a cyanide pill. I mean, in case I have to,
yeah.
and bite it, don't swallow. And she really did kind of go with it because she seemed really driven by patriotism.
Yeah, and that was very common back then, the cause. We were really a very united country, unlike many of the times, unlike now. And everybody was patriotic, and you did your part. and that really inspired people.
So she's recruited into this spy service that is international. I mean, there's people from French and British and Scotland. There's a colorful trainer, and mm-hmm. it was almost like going to college, learning disguises, learning how to disarm people, even learning how to kill people. And since you say this is all based on fact, so mm-hmm. these kind of institutions really did exist.
Yes. And it was so fortunate that Camp X was located in Toronto. I went to a college in upstate New York right on Lake Ontario. And I was so excited about that because I knew the area so well. And I had been to Toronto. And I wanted a glider plane part in it. So I had her husband be a glider pilot. And I was excited to find out that the glider capital of the world was Elmira, New York. And I had gone to a community college there. So I knew Harris Hill. So I always end up having these amazing coincidences that really help my writing. You know, it's like it's so great if I have to write about spy camp in Toronto that I don't have to go there. I've been there.
And intimately know it. You just mentioned gliders. Her husband, he also seems to respond to some kind of ad. Leads him into being trained as a glider pilot.
Yeah.
When I think of a glider, I think of a one or two seat glider. But it sounds like these gliders were huge.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about these gliders that were used in World War II.
You know, the gliders were pretty amazing because they were motorless, so you were towed up into the air, and then the cable is released, and you're on your own. So the pilot is soaring through the air without a motor. And these were huge, ugly beasts, they called them. They could fit many, many troops of men and even bulldozers. And the whole huge nose of it could be pushed when they landed, could be pushed open, and then they come out of it. And gliders, this particular glider that I studied, which was the most common, the Waco glider, it is quiet on the outside, so it's easy to sneak into enemy territory. But inside, it sounds like a beating drum, and it's just can drive you crazy by the canvas. So it was fun, really fun to read about the gliders.
And sometimes it sounds like they had some mishaps with them.
Yes, they certainly did. In the experimental and beginning of them, they had all these dignitaries go up and try to show people how safe and wonderful they are, and it crashed because it was not manufactured correctly.
Since this is steeped in reality, in your book, we have the fiction part of it, and the book is peppered with a lot of archival pictures from the time. Then at the end of the book, you have some bios of actual women who, when I read through them, well, their stories resonated with, mm-hmm. with, I thought, oh, okay, that's where you got that. Even somebody with a Cuthbert, a wooden leg, or
Cuthbert, yes. The limping lady.
Spy with a fake leg.
And she's on the front cover. The front cover is a Virginia Hall typing on her wireless transmitter, and that's a man running a bicycle generator for it to work. This is a painting, and it's hanging in the CIA presently. But Virginia Hall was an extremely amazing woman to read about, as Vera Atkins, I so admired because she sent the women into occupied Paris and was involved in their training, that after the war was over, that she spent her own personal time trying to find out what happened to the death of many of the women spies.
There were deaths of these women spies, and a lot of them were providing critical communication through passing on information through Morse code, moving around to different locations or safe houses. Mm-hmm. And did you also go abroad to do some of your research?
I did go to Paris and do some research. I ended up finding much more information for a new book I'm working on in Prague. It seems like all my books have been full of hands-on experience, and I never know how a story's going to go, and that's it turned out to be a big adventure. I was not planning on going to Europe. I have a daughter who wanted to take a year abroad, and she picked Prague University just because they spoke English. And she was there for about 6 months, and she got really lonely and begged me to come to Prague. And I did not want to go to Prague. I had no interest in Prague.
Until you got there, huh?
Well, Jan, just coincidentally, she had me stay in a hostel. Was a brand new hostel. It was very nice. I had my own room, which was very handy because I ended up doing a lot of research in that room. And it was just a block from the military museum, which I had no idea it would be. And I discovered just wonderful stories in that museum that I'm going to be using in my new book.
So it's in your blood to write historical fiction.
It just happened that way. I didn't know this would be my life. But one thing just seems to lead to another. All three books are not related also. They're only related because they have amazing women of the 40s in them.
They do create a real vivid picture of those war years and maybe some roles women played that many of us are unfamiliar with. So, Jeannie Sloan, thank you, and thanks for bringing this kind of information to us in a fun and accessible way.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed the book so much.
My conversation with Jeannie Sloan. Jeannie also distributes local authors' books in shops all over Sonoma County, and she is the driving force behind the Dining with Authors events at Gaia's Garden in Santa Rosa, California. Earlier in the broadcast, I spoke with Linda Hervieux on her important book, Forgotten, The Untold Story of D-Day's Black Heroes, At Home and at War. We've featured music today from Sounds of Blackness and Black Lives Matter, No Justice, No Peace, from Count Basie and his orchestra, and from Leslie Hutchinson and his Colored Orchestra. We've had production assistance from Sean Knight and Mark Prell. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcasts and listen anytime. All our past shows are available as podcasts. Visit us online at krcb.org. I'm Suzanne Lang. Thank you for listening. It's a novel idea.